It's Bigler's World, Bigler's World, on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And that's going to make me Jim Bigler for the next hour, I guess. I don't know. I got all kinds of magazines. What am I going to read here today? I'll start out with some news for kids, do some National Geographic Kids Magazine. They call it Nat Geo. Maybe some science news for kids. Let's start here with newsforkids.net. Human-like robots run half marathon in China. What, they couldn't run the whole marathon? I don't get it. Beijing, China. Last Saturday, which was actually the Saturday before last Saturday, a half marathon was held in Beijing, China. About 12,000 runners took part. On a separate track, beside the human runners, 21 humanoid, that's parentheses human-like, robots, tackled the same challenge. It was the first race of its kind. Despite the challenges, six robots finished the race out of 21. Saturday's race was held in Yitown, that's a technology center in Beijing. There have been robot races before, but not this long. A half marathon is 13.1 miles. The distance was meant to challenge the robots and allow their developers to see how the robots managed under real-life conditions. The robots that raced were different shapes and sizes. The largest, called the Tiangong Ultra, was 5 feet 8 inches tall. The smallest, called Little Giant, was just under 2.5 feet tall. To join the race, the robots had to run on 2 feet like humans. Each robot started at a slightly different time, a good idea, since some of the robots fell down right at the start. To give each robot the best chance, each traveled with support workers and a van holding supply parts and even replacement robots. There was a 10-minute time penalty for replacing a robot, by the way. Support workers carried devices to control their robots. Some workers followed their robots. Others led them. The robots were kept on a leash. This is sounding like me. Workers helping fast robots had to jog the whole time. Those with slower robots just walked. The early part of the race was the easiest because the course was flat. Later, things became more difficult. The course had 14 turns, and there were small hills to run up or down. In some places, railroad tracks crossed the road, and the robots had to manage the uneven surface. As with human runners, low energy was a problem for the robots, too. Tiangong fell once because of low battery. The same thing happened to other robots, too. The biggest challenge was probably overheating. It was cool in the morning, but as the day heated up, the workers had to keep spraying the robots to keep them cool. At one point, Little Giant had smoke coming out of his head. The first robot to cross the finish line was Tiangong. It finished the race in 2 hours, 40 minutes, and 42 seconds. That was far behind most human runners, but the goal of the race wasn't to win, it was to finish, and six of the robots met that goal. Second and third place went to two different versions of the same small robot, N2. One was set to run fast, the other was set to go as far as possible on a set of batteries. Near the end of the race, the second one fell down and its head rolled off. Once again, that's me. But after support workers taped its head back on, it was able to cross the finish line. Let's see, the race was a success, even for the robots who didn't finish. Their efforts produced a lot of information that will help their developers improve future humanoid robots. And at the bottom here it says, did you know China and the U.S. are both working hard to develop artificial intelligence and robots. Both areas are expected to be hugely important in the future. As tensions increase between the two countries, China is eager to show that it can compete with and perhaps beat the U.S. in these areas. Next article here. On Bigler's World, let's go over to National Geographic Kids Magazine. They got a quiz. Haven't done a quiz in a while. This quiz is on desert animals, and it's by Karina Schenk. Desert animals are tough. They have to be in order to survive in this extreme habitat. Find out how much you know about these critters with this fun quiz based on facts from Nat Geo Kids Magazine. Okay, the first one they got here. Let's see, is this a tortoise here? True or false? Desert tortoises stay cool by crowding together in underground burrows. I don't like the idea of that. I don't care if it's true or false. I'm going to say false. Okay, it says here, wrong. I pretty much figured I would be. To beat the heat, desert tortoises use their strong forearms and tough claws to dig underground burrows that shade them from the sun. Some tortoise tunnels are up to 32 feet long, and the burrows can get pretty crowded. As many as 25 desert tortoises might bunk together in one shelter. Okay, next up here. What's a nictitating membrane? Is that something that helps desert animals sweat more? Is it a special organ to help desert insects fly? Is it a third eyelid? Or is it what makes some animals glow in the dark? I'm going to say a third eyelid, and I'm going to be correct on that. Meerkats, members of the mongoose family that live in the deserts and grasslands of southern Africa, have a special third eyelid known as a nictitating membrane. It helps keep out the sand. I could use one of those, I'm telling you. Next up, how often does a gerenuk, is that how you pronounce it? G-E-R-E-N-U-K, gerenuk. How often does a gerenuk, a long-necked antelope that lives in the deserts throughout East Africa, need to drink water? Every hour, every day, once a month, or never? Given how skinny it is, I'm going to say once a month. It says I'm wrong. Gerenuks never need to drink water. I should have chosen never. I never even thought about that. Instead, they get moisture they need from the plants they eat. That is crazy stuff. Which body part does a fennec fox use to radiate heat and keep cool? It's got these gigantic ears. I'm going to go with that. Is it their nails, their tail, their ears, or their nose? And I am correct on that one. Fennec foxes, sometimes called desert foxes because they live in desert zones of North Africa and the Sinai and the Arabian peninsulas, they use their bat-like ears to expel body heat and keep cool. They also can use their giant ears to hear tiny insects moving around underground. Or for that matter, tiny insects moving around inside their gigantic ears. The next one up here, true or false? When food is scarce, desert-dwelling scorpions can live off just one insect a year. Why not? It says correct. A scorpion can slow down its metabolism. That's the process that animals use to get energy from food, so much that some species are able to live off a single insect a year. I'm not even sure that qualifies as being alive. Next one up here. Black-tailed jackrabbits can reach speeds up to 10 miles an hour, 20 miles an hour, 40, or 60 miles an hour. I don't know. I guess I'll go with 40. I am correct. The black-tailed jackrabbit, also known as the American desert hare, can reach speeds of up to 40 miles an hour. Their powerful hind legs can propel them more than 10 feet forward. That, plus a zigzag jumping style, helps them escape predators like coyotes. Or my father with the 30-06. Last one here, true or false, all camels have two humps. Well, I think we know that that's not true. Although, is this a trick question? I'm going to say all camels have two humps. I'm going to say false on that. And I'm correct here. Bactrian camels, they have two humps. But Arabian camels, called dromedaries, have only one hump. Both Bactrian and Arabian camels store fat in their humps that they use for energy and water when they're far from food and freshwater sources. Okay, next thing here, sticking with National Geographic Kids Magazine. Nat Geo. Let's see, that was a quiz. This is just a regular article on cicadas. Cicadas. This is by Allison Shaw. Some species of cicada live as long as 17 years, though most of the time is spent underground. Their common name is cicada. And their scientific name is Cicadodia. I guess that is. They are an invertebrate. They're an herbivore. Their group name is a cloud or a plague. And when a million of them are outside your window at night, they're a plague. Average lifespan in the wild, up to 17 years. And their size is 0.75 to 2.25 inches. Have you ever heard a buzzing sound in the summertime? It might be a male cicada trying to impress a mate. But depending on where you live and what year it is, you may not hear just a few buzzing bugs hanging out in the trees.
Things might get so loud you won't hear anything else but the buzzing. A bug's life. Cicadas start their lives as eggs. Females lay 200 to 400 eggs in tiny holes that they make in branches of trees and shrubs. After 6 to 10 weeks, cicada young, called nymphs, they hatch from the eggs and immediately fall to the ground. They burrow underground and attach to tree roots. The nymphs stay buried in to suck up tree sap from 2 to 17 years, depending on the species. When this underground life called the dormant period ends, the cicadas emerge above ground at sunset, climb the trunk of a nearby tree, and shed their skin. Now they're adult cicadas. Next, male cicadas fill the air with a shrill buzzing sound created by rapidly vibrating drum-like plates on their abdomens. The females make clicking sounds with their wings if they like the song. They mate, lay their eggs, and then both male and female cicadas die after just about 5 weeks above ground. Two types. Scientists divide the over 3,000 cicada species into two groups, annual and periodical. Annual cicadas emerge from the ground at different times each summer. They're usually dark with greenish markings. These insects avoid predators by camouflaging themselves in the trees and by flying from hungry birds and moles. Okay, apparently moles really like them. Only 7 species of cicada are in the other group called the periodical cicadas. These bugs all emerge from the ground at the same time. Called broods, these groups appear after a dormant period of either 13 or 17 years. That's a long nap. Periodical cicadas live only in the central and eastern part of the United States. They have black backs, there it is, orange bellies and red eyes. Millions or even billions of cicadas might come out all at once, so these bugs aren't trying to hide. They survive by having such a large population that predators couldn't possibly eat them all at once. Big noise. A different periodical brood emerges almost every year in different parts of the country. Some broods are small, like brood, 7? The Roman numeral for 7, there it is, which is found only in upstate New York. But others are huge. In the summer of 2021, hundreds of billions of cicadas in brood X buzzed through the parts of Delaware, Georgia, Illinois, Indiana, there's a lot of states here, Kentucky, Maryland, Michigan, North Carolina, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, and Washington, D.C. Although the emergence might sound scary, these bugs aren't harmful. They don't attack people, and they don't bite or sting, and they don't destroy crops. So just enjoy the sights and the sounds. Okay, I'll do one more thing from National Geographic Kids magazine. This is a thing on the United Kingdom. Just in case you thought you knew everything about the United Kingdom, I'll bet you didn't. Located off the northwest coast of Europe, the United Kingdom includes England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. Here's some fast facts. Official name is the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Form of government, it's a parliamentary democracy within a constitutional monarchy. The capital is London. Population is 67,879,000. The official languages are English. And then there's both English and Scots Gaelic in Scotland, both English and Welsh in Wales. The money, it's the pound sterling. How big is it? Well, it's 93,630 square miles. And you got some major rivers here, the Thames, the Severn, the Trent, and the Mersey. Okay, so geography. The biggest part of the United Kingdom, also called the UK, is the island of Great Britain, which is made up of England, Wales, and Scotland. The UK also includes Northern Ireland, which is on another island. South of Northern Ireland is the separate country of Ireland, which gained its independence from the UK back in 1937. Northern Ireland is just 12 miles from the island of Great Britain across the North Channel of the Irish Sea. Scotland and Wales are the most mountainous parts of the UK. They are covered in knife-edged mountain ridges, separated by deep valleys. The terrain was shaped some 20,000 years ago during the last ice age, when thick glaciers covered the land. When the ice age glaciers melted in northwest Scotland, they left behind thousands of lakes called lochs. There's a loch over there. Long and narrow, some of the lochs are very deep. Legends say that a giant monster called Nessie lives in Loch Ness in this region, also called the Scottish Highlands. The largest freshwater lake by surface area in the UK is Lough Neagh, pronounced Lochney. It is in Northern Ireland. It stretches 20 miles long and 9 miles wide. Rolling hills and plains dot the countryside of both Northern Ireland and England. People and culture. Many people from the United Kingdom are descendants of the Celtic migrants. There's a Celtic, I think it's Celtic, from Central Europe, who arrived in the UK, possibly as early as 1000 BC. There it is. Other ancestors of UK citizens were Roman invaders who arrived in AD 43 and Viking warriors who landed in AD 739. Both of those came from mainland Europe. After the end of World War II in 1945, thousands of refugees from other war-torn European countries settled in the UK. In the 1950s and 60s, people from places that the United Kingdom once ruled as colonies, such as Jamaica in the Caribbean, Nigeria in Africa, and India in Asia, came to the country to work. Today, more than 80% of the people in the United Kingdom live in England. London, the capital of both England and the UK, is home to just under 9 million residents. Nearly half the UK's population is Christian, with most belonging to Protestant churches. The country is also home to large and growing communities of Muslims, Hindus, and Jews. The UK is known all over the world for its sports and literature. Soccer, rugby, cricket, boxing, and golf were all invented in the United Kingdom. And the UK has produced many notable writers, including William Shakespeare, maybe you've heard of him, Charles Dickens, and Jane Austen. J.K. Rowling, the writer of the Harry Potter series, and J.R.R. Tolkien, the writer of the Lord of the Rings series, are both from the UK. How about some nature? About 5,000 years ago, much of the United Kingdom was covered with thick forests. Over time, these woodlands were cleared by farmers and land developers. Today, only about 13% of the UK's land is forest. The United Kingdom is a crowded country with few truly wild places left. The most successful wildlife species are those that can live alongside people, including smaller mammals like hedgehogs, hares, and badgers. Roe deer, that's R-O-E, roe deer, which are native to the country, and red deer are the largest mammals found in the UK. The Scottish Highlands, which are largely untouched by humans, are home to animals like the Scottish wild cat, pine martens, and golden eagles. Loch Neagh in Northern Ireland is home to some 20 species of waterfowl, including ducks, gulls, geese, and swans. In Wales, one of the most spotted mammals is the red fox. The visitors can also see Leigh's white-beam trees, which grow only in Wales. In England's moors, open areas with poor soil covered by grass and a purplish flowering plant called heather, visitors can see venomous adder snakes and emperor moths and ground-nesting birds called snipes. The United Kingdom's 7,723 miles of coastline, ranging from tall cliffs to beaches to marshes, provide homes for seabirds like puffins and great scaws. How do you pronounce that? S-K-U-A-S? Squaws? I don't know what that is. Minke whales, bottlenose dolphins, and orcas can be spotted in the waters surrounding the UK. What do they got here next? Government. Government and economy. The UK system of government has developed over many centuries. As early as the 9th century, kings and queens ruled with advice from a council of religious leaders and nobles. Today, the country is a constitutional monarchy, which means the reigning king or queen is the head of state, but doesn't have any real political power. The old Council of Advisors eventually expanded into a government body called the Parliament. That's why today the United Kingdom's system of government is called a parliamentary democracy. Members of the Parliament now pass all of the country's laws from two chambers, the House of Commons, made up of officials elected by the people, and the House of Lords, in which members are appointed, usually by the reigning king or queen, based on recommendations by an independent group called the House of Lords Appointments Commission.
This is getting complicated.
The head of the government is the Prime Minister, who is usually the leader of the political party in charge of Parliament. And they got oil, iron, and steel products are some of the United Kingdom's main exports or goods sold to other countries. The country also exports electrical equipment and parts for automobiles and aircrafts. Its main crops include barley, wheat, and potatoes. Over the centuries, the United Kingdom has accumulated wealth from foreign lands the country colonized or took over. Some estimates say the UK earned as much as $45 trillion in today's dollars just from its former colonies in India, when trade from goods that India produced went to the UK's economy. Other former colonies include Australia, Canada, and South Africa. Weren't we a colony? The United States? History. Early history. Among the first Britons, the people who live in the United Kingdom, were the Picts, P-I-C-T-S, who arrived some 10,000 years ago, likely from mainland Europe. In the 6th century B.C., the Celts arrived from Europe, and the Picts moved north into Scotland. In A.D. 43, the Romans invaded and ruled for nearly 400 years. They built roads, bathhouses, and sewers. By the 6th century A.D., German people known as the Angles, the Jutes or Utes, and the Saxons, they were moving into the U.K. The Angles gave their name to England, and English people became known as Anglo-Saxons. From the 900s to the 1400s, England was ruled by Viking, Danish, and Norman invaders. Many different Celtic kingdoms maintained control throughout Ireland and Wales for hundreds of years, and the ancestors of the Picts still ruled over Scotland. Uniting the kingdom. In the 13th century, England took control of Wales. About 200 years later, in 1485, Welsh noble Henry Tudor claimed the English crown and became Henry the VII, the first of five Tudor monarchs. The Welsh territory was officially united with England in 1536. After many battles to keep its independence, Scotland eventually united with England in 1707. The union of the three nations, England, Wales, and Scotland, became the Kingdom of Great Britain, ruled by Queen Anne, who became the first monarch of the newly formed Great Britain. The Celts, who ruled over Ireland, also fought to remain independent from England, which had been invading the country since the late 1100s. By the late 1600s, England had gained control of all of Ireland. Ireland officially became united with England, Scotland, and Wales in 1801, forming the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. Colonization. Eager to find the wealth that Portugal and Spain had found after taking control of other lands, the UK began establishing colonies in what would eventually become the United States. In 1607, Jamestown, in what is now the state of Virginia, became the first permanent English settlement in the Americas. But in the 18th century, American colonists began to rebel against the British rule. They fought for their independence during the Revolutionary War, which lasted from 1775 to 1783. Americans won the war and their independence. After the loss of its American colonies, the UK shifted its attention to Asia. It established the East India Trading Company to trade in what is now Indonesia, India, and other parts of Southeast Asia. The company's control of trade in the region eventually led to the colonization of India in 1858. By the mid-1800s, the United Kingdom was one of the most powerful nations in the world. The country built a huge overseas empire, setting up colonies throughout Africa and even Canada in North America. These colonies were part of the British Empire, which ruled more than one quarter of the world's people by the 1900s. The early 20th century, In the late 19th century, Germany began competing with the UK and other European countries to set up colonies in Africa and Asia. These tensions led to World War I in 1914. The United Kingdom, alongside France, Italy, Japan, and the United States, and the Soviet Union, now called Russia, defeated Germany, Austria, Hungary, Bulgaria, and the Ottoman Empire to win the war in 1918. In the middle of World War I, protesters calling for independence in Ireland stage an uprising on Easter Monday in 1916. Known as the Easter Rising, the revolt was stopped and many of its Irish leaders were executed. But many people in Ireland still wanted to be independent from the UK. In 1919, the Irish Republic Army, or the IRA, fought the British Army in the Irish War of Independence, which lasted until 1921. A truce in 1921 led to the Irish Free State Act of 1922, which stated that the southern part of Ireland would become the Irish Free State, a self-governing country with some ties to the United Kingdom. Six countries in the north chose to remain counties, not countries, six counties in the north chose to remain part of the UK and become Northern Ireland. Eventually, in 1937, the Irish Free State, now known as Ireland, became a fully independent republic. By 1949, they had no ties to the UK. During Ireland's ongoing fight for independence, the UK found itself involved in another world war when Germany's Adolf Hitler and his Nazi party invaded Poland in 1939, starting World War II. The United Kingdom, alongside the United States and the Soviet Union, fought against Germany, Italy, and Japan, called the Axis powers. The war ended in 1945 with the Axis countries defeated. The United Kingdom spent a lot of money fighting and recovering from World War I and II. Unable to support and oversee its empire, it withdrew from some of its colonies, allowing them to become independent. India, often referred to as the crown jewel of the British Empire, had been pushing for independence for decades before the world wars. Indian activist Mahatma Gandhi joined the fight in 1914 by encouraging his fellow Indians to engage in nonviolent forms of protest, such as not buying UK goods and refusing to pay taxes. Although the struggle for independence sometimes turned violent, Gandhi's leadership helped India become its own country in 1947. In 1952, Elizabeth II became queen. During her 70-year reign, more than 50 countries that were colonies of the British Empire became independent. This period of history has been called the decolonization of the British Empire. Trouble in Northern Ireland. People in Northern Ireland started fighting for independence during the 1960s, sometimes called the Troubles. The conflict was mostly between nationalists who wanted to leave the United Kingdom and form a united Ireland, and the Unionists who wanted Northern Ireland to remain part of the UK. Like most of Ireland, nationalists were Catholic, Unionists were Protestant, like many in the UK. The violent conflict mostly took place in Northern Ireland, but fighting occasionally happened in England and Ireland as well. Nearly 4,000 people died during the Troubles, which lasted until the Good Friday Agreement was signed in 1988. Also called the Belfast Agreement, the peace talks formed a new government in Northern Ireland that would allow Unionists and Nationalists to share power as part of the United Kingdom. Brexit and the death of Queen Elizabeth II. In 1973, the United Kingdom joined the European Union, or the EU. It was in 73. Member countries, all from Europe, follow certain trade, security, immigration, and environmental laws. But some UK residents didn't like that they had to follow these laws. The country voted to leave the EU in 2016 and officially left in January of 2020. People around the world called the United Kingdom's departure Brexit, a combination of Britain and exit. On September 20th, September of 2022, that's what it actually says here, Queen Elizabeth II died at 96 years old after 70 years on the throne. Her son, Charles, became king. Under his reign, decolonization will likely continue. The latest country to leave the British monarchy behind was Barbados, And that was in 2021. Okay, let's go to another publication here on Bigler's World on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Let's do a little Dogo news for kids. This article entitled OK Go's Latest Music Video features 29 robots and 60 mirrors. Kavi Dolazio wrote this particular article. It goes a little like this. American rock band OK Go is known for blending music, engineering, and visual art in their videos. Their first hit, Here It Goes Again, featured the band performing a choreographed routine on moving treadmills. The video went viral and became one of the most talked about releases of the year. Oh, yes. Their latest video, Love, released on April 11th of this year, 2025, reaffirms the band's status as innovators in music filmmakers. Love was filmed during winter at an unheated train station in Budapest, Hungary. Or is that Budapest? The video features a precisely choreographed performance involving 29 robotic arms and 60 mirrors. It took 39 takes to perfect the required crew of more than 60 people. The team included engineers and roboticists. The result is a vibrant, ever-changing visual that captivates viewers. I'm captivated. Love appears on OK Go's new album and The Adjacent Possible. That's the name of the album. It is the group's first album in over a decade. Their previous album, Hungry Ghosts, was released in 2014. With the latest release, the band once again has shown that music videos can be more than just promotional tools. They can be immersive, artistic experiences. Next article. Sticking with Dogo news, lunar caves could be used to house future astronauts, says Mihaka Shakarpe. Or is it just Shakarp? One of the biggest challenges for long-term stays on the moon is creating safe shelters for astronauts. Researchers have long believed that lunar caves might be the answer. These natural shelters could protect astronauts from the extreme temperature swings and constant exposure to space radiation. They might even have water ice. However, finding such caves has proved elusive. That changed in July of 2024 with the discovery of a sizable cave just 250 miles from the Apollo 11 landing site. This is where Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin became the first humans to set foot on the moon. Scientists at Italy's University of Trento identified the cave using data from NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. It has been mapping the moon's surface since 2009. The cave lies about 130 feet underground. It is estimated to be 147 feet wide and at least 98 feet long. The Italian scientists believe hundreds more such caverns may exist across the moon. Let's see, who is this? Team leader Lorenzo Bruzzone. Is that Lorenzo Bruzzone? He says, these caves have been theorized for over 50 years, but it is the first time ever that we have demonstrated their existence. While the discovery is exciting, researchers still need to determine whether the caves are safe to serve as homes. Their roofs and walls may need to be strengthened to ensure astronaut safety. I hope so. The habitat will also require systems to detect moonquakes. Additionally, scientists will need to identify safe zones for astronauts to use in case the cave collapses. Even if the caves prove unstable for human habitation, they could still hold scientific value. Their rocky composition might offer insights into the moon's volcanic history and the early solar system. The information could help in planning future missions to Mars. Lunar caves likely formed from ancient volcanic activity on the moon. As molten lava flowed beneath the surface, the outer layer cooled and hardened, while the inner lava kept moving. Once the eruption ended, the lava drained away, leaving behind hollow tunnels called lava tubes. Over time, parts of the roof collapsed, creating surface openings that look like deep pits. Okay, let's do one more article here in Dogo News. Free Comic Book Day is on May 3rd. Kavi Dolazio wrote this article. Do you like comic books? Then you will be pleased to know that May 3rd of this year, 2025, is Free Comic Book Day, or FCBD. This means that you can walk into any of over 2,300 participating retailers worldwide and pick up a free comic. Now it's in its 23rd year. The global event is held annually on the first Saturday in May. This fun event was introduced in 2002, there it is, by Joe Field, who was inspired by the success of Ben and Jerry's Free Cone Day. The comic book retailer believed it would help introduce a new generation of readers to the magical world of graphic novels. With support from other retailers, publishers, and distributors, FCBD became a reality. Publishers added to the fun by releasing exclusive titles just for the occasion. This year's FCBD features about 50 titles. Marvel fans can pick up comics starting at the Fantastic Four, starring the Fantastic Four, X-Men, Iron Man, you got your Spider-Man, and the Hulk. Fans of DC Comics are in for a treat. The publisher is offering its first ever FCBD flip book. One side highlights the exciting adventures of Superman. The flip side introduces a powerful new addition to the DC Universe. Whether this character is a hero or villain will only be revealed by grabbing a coffee, or a copy for that matter. And you got to grab it. You can't just pick it up. DC will also release a fun graphic novel featuring an 8-year-old Clark Kent, a.k.a. Superman, for early readers. Young fans can also enjoy titles based on Green Eggs and Ham by Dr. Seuss and a Minecraft manga-style comic. I'll take their word for that. Who is this? Ashton, FCBD spokesperson, Ashton Greenwood says, "We're excited for another fantastic year of celebrating comic books and the shops that make them special. This year's selection has something for every kind of fan. Whether you're new to comics or a longtime reader, you're sure to find a title that grabs your attention." Once again, you got to grab it. Even if the free titles do not interest you, visiting your local comic book store on FCBD is still worth it. Many stores offer discounts on their entire comic selection, and they also have exclusive FCBD merchandise and apparel. Okay, next up, let's go over to Scout Life. It's not boys' life anymore. It's a Scout Life. Michael Freeman wrote this article entitled Go Native. Go Native. Field book facts. An invasive species is a plant or animal that doesn't naturally grow or live in an ecosystem, but has been introduced to it and is thriving to the point that it's harming native plants and animals. Good stewardship of our environment requires removing invasive species, especially plants. If we don't, these species can disrupt biodiversity, change the habitat, and even lead to the extinction of native species. Before removing any plant, first consult with the land manager. Land managers can help identify plants and share when to remove them and how to dispose of them. If a plant cannot be identified, it's better to leave it. Be prepared, Scout, be prepared for such service by wearing gloves, long-sleeved shirts, and long pants, especially since some weeds might have thorns or irritating sap. For stubborn plants, use shovels and other garden tools to remove them. After the plants have been removed, work with the land manager to figure out if a native plant should go in its place. Native grasses, bushes, and trees help maintain a balance of the ecosystem. Before planting native plants, research the right time to plant them so they can survive, as well as the type of soil they grow well in, proper drainage, and how much sunlight they'll be exposed to. You can also consult the land manager or seed producer to determine how to correctly plant a certain species and what tools are best to use. You got to consult that land guy. Otherwise, he's going to get really mad. Let's do another article. In fact, we have several of them here. In Scout Life, Rowing to Success is the name of this article here. Let's see. These are all about scouts that have done amazing things. Life Scout wins gold. Scout Life headliner. Scouts and others with big stories. Graham Richardson, the first one they got here, age 15, hometown Ridgewood, New Jersey. He is a Life Scout with Troop 5 in Ridgewood. He made headlines for winning gold at the 2023 Head of the Schuylkill Regatta. I guess that's how you pronounce that. Here's a scoop on Graham. Graham won the freshman/novice category at the Jim Barker Men's High School Single Race at this prestigious event, which included nearly 2,200 competitors from around the world. Graham had a time of 15 minutes, 26 seconds on the 4,150-meter course. In 2024, he won gold medals at the Haddam Hammer and Winter Watt Farm Indoor Ergometer, there it is, rowing machine competitions, and silver medals at the Cooper Cup under 17 and the Ironman Ergometer, is that right? Ergometer competition, all at the middle school level. And there's more of these here. I'm going to read them in a second. But do you know someone who's making headlines? Let us know. You can go to the internet, go.scoutlife.org/headliners. Okay. We got some other stuff. Ask the gear guy, because he knows everything. Let's see, the department. How much should I spend on a flashlight? Says Emily from Toledo, Ohio. And the gear guy says, well, as with any piece of gear, first consider how you'll use it. If you want a big, tough flashlight to keep in the top trailer, or patrol box, you can get something like the Affinity X1, that's $40, which is made with aircraft-grade aluminum and weighs a hefty 2.2 pounds. For a little pocket light that can help you find stuff in your tent late at night, the Scout Shop sells models from Nebo, N-E-B-O, and Night Eyes, N-I-T-E-I-Z-E, some for less than $15. For a quality flashlight to use around camp, I'd budget between $15 and $30. You can find quite a few in that price range at the Scout Shop. You can, of course, invest more for features like rechargeable batteries, brighter bulbs, and more durable materials. One flashlight I like is the Life Gear Searchlight 300. That's $20. On one end is a bulb capable of producing 300 lumens of light on its brightest setting. And the other end is a built-in emergency whistle as well as another bulb that blinks. The blinking bulb can be seen up to 2.5 miles away, making this light a nice addition to your survival kit. Okay, what else they got here? Let's see. That stuff we like. Backcountry. I'm just kind of looking over what I'm going to read. Learning how to read a map and navigate with it is an essential scouting skill. Well, I hope so. Most maps, though, won't tell you where the wildfires are burning, what the weather will be, or what places are susceptible to avalanches. The ONX, is that ONX Backcountry app, that's $30 a year, can do all of that, plus suggest nearby trails based on distance and difficulty. A yearly membership to the app, available on iOS and Android, provides topographic, satellite, and hybrid maps for hundreds of thousands of miles of hiking trails that can be accessed online and offline. It also features routes for mountain biking, backcountry skiing, and rock climbing. Upgrades let you pinpoint where your private property lines are and check out 3D satellite imagery that is updated every 2 weeks. You can try the app with a free 7-day trial there. Okay, so we're back to the back to kids wanting stuff. This kid says, I'm looking for sandals on a beach camp out for this summer. What should I get? That's Kurt from Augusta, Georgia. He says, well, you can find a cheap pair of flip-flops for a few bucks. They'll work for a weekend camp out where you're just walking across the sand. But if you're planning on going on more aquatic outings, especially on rocky beaches, you might want to think about sturdier sandals. Combat flip-flops, Coyote Flopperator, those are $50. And Extra Tufts Ana Sandal, those are $75, are good choices. They both have arch support, quality straps, grippy soles, and thick midsoles, providing comfort and protection for a long day at the beach. Those are all the features to look for when shopping for sandals. Before you buy any shoe, go to a store and try on a pair. You might prefer footwear with heel straps or plastic clogs, both of which offer more support than flip-flops. Or you could opt for a sports sandal with closed toes that you can also use for hiking. Oh, yes. Okay, what do they got here? One more article in Scout Life. What is this? Animal honors. Excuse me. Whether fearless or funny, animals throughout history have inspired statues and memorials as early as ancient Egypt. Here are some monuments still standing today. They got a statue in Istanbul. That's in Turkey, by the way. Remembers Tambili, a street cat whose hilarious reclining pose photo went viral. How about Hachiko? That's a dog famous for its loyalty. Is memorialized in bronze. That's in Tokyo, Japan. After Hachiko's owner died in 1925, the dog returned to a train station for years to wait for him. A New York City Central Park features a statue of Balto, one of the sled dogs who braved dangerous conditions to take medicine to sick children in Nome, Alaska, in 1925. Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, has a statue honoring Winnie the Bear, named after Winnipeg, who inspired author A.A. Milne to create Winnie the Pooh. Then there's National Dog Bite Prevention Week. That's held every April. That raises awareness about the risks of dog bites. They just decided to throw this in here. More than 4 million people in the United States are bitten each year, with about 20% requiring medical attention. Here are a few ways that you can prevent a dog bite. First off, it says, beware of your surroundings. Don't approach an unfamiliar dog. If a dog approaches you, stay calm. You don't want to startle the dog with loud noises or fast movements, like if you just broke into the Charleston. Remember that dogs can be territorial. Try not to disturb them while they're eating, sleeping, or caring for their puppies. Okay, one more. I'm going to do one more in Scout Life. It's about submarines. Okay, submarines help scientists explore and the military discover new things about our oceans. Here's some fast facts. Heads up. National Submarine Day was April 11th. Sorry, we missed it. Darn it. Some submarines are powered by nuclear energy, letting them stay submerged for months without needing to refuel. They are very quiet, allowing them to sneak up on other ships and avoid detection. Because of this, the submarine force of the U.S. Navy has the nickname the Silent Service. The HMS Vengeance holds the record for staying submerged for more than 6 months, the longest in history. Submarines use a system called ballast tanks to float and dive. Some submarines can dive as deep as 36,000 feet. That's deeper than Mount Everest is tall. And one last little thing they got here. Tiny submarines are called submersibles. Okay, let us go over to some science news explorers. Let's learn about memory, is the name of this article. Brain cell connections underlie this ability to recall facts and reminisce about the past, says Maria Temming, who wrote this article. Think about a fact that you recently had to memorize for a test, or a song that's been stuck in your head, or how you felt when you last hung out with a friend. All the sights, sounds, and other sensations those words brought to mind are memories, experiences, and information your brain had filed away. These stored data play a huge role in how we understand the world, our relationships with people in it, and ourselves. But how does the brain make memories? When you experience something, brain cells called neurons send each other signals. Those electrical pulses zip through links between neurons called synapses. The more often you experience something, the more often certain sets of neurons will talk to each other, and the more they talk, the stronger the links between them become. Scientists generally think those neural circuits encode memories, though some researchers have shown that other types of brain cells may play a role too. One recent study showed that sparse yet strong links between neurons in the hippocampus, the brain's memory center, maximize info storage. Several factors can get in the way of a brain's ability to retain information. Injuries, such as concussions, can make it harder to remember stuff. Marijuana use has also been linked to foggier memories in young people. Frequent multitasking, too, seems to get in the way of recall, even when you're trying to focus on one thing at a time. On the flip side, there are many ways to boost memory. If you're studying for a test, quizzing yourself and looking at pictures can help you hold on to information. Writing by hand rather than by typing also seems to help. If you want to improve your memory more generally, exercise is useful. It increases blood flow to the brain. So is eating a healthy diet that feeds the brain much-needed nutrients. Next article. Sticking with Science News Explorers, physics finally explains the sound of clapping. Well, it's about time. An acoustic phenomenon called Helmholtz resonance is the answer. They got a picture of somebody clapping their hands, and for some reason, dust is coming all over the place. Emily Conover wrote this. A round of applause, please. Scientists have finally figured out what's behind the sound of hand clapping. It's the same concept at work when you make sound by blowing across the top of an empty bottle. Helmholtz resonance is a formal scientific name. New experiments use baby powder, that's what they're doing there, to map the flow of air emitted by hand clapping. This confirmed that clapping hands become Helmholtz resonators. Well, I hope so. Pressure measurements and high-speed video of clapping backed up those findings. By the way, the researchers shared their results in a paper accepted in Physical Review Research. Pick yours up today. To make Helmholtz resonator, all you need is an enclosed pocket of air with an opening connected by a neck inside of a glass bottle. That works. So does the space between clapping hands. As air vibrates back and forth within the neck, it creates sound waves. The pitch of those waves depends on the volume of the air pocket. It also depends on the dimensions of the neck and opening. When someone claps their hands, a jet of air streams out of a gap where the hands meet. It goes between the thumb and forefinger. Let's see, who is this? Yaikong Fu. I didn't say who he is, but somebody named Yaikong Fu says this. This jet of air carries energy, the initial start of the sound. The jet kicks off vibrations in the air. Fu, here he is, he's a mechanical engineer at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. His group saw a similar effect when they used cup-shaped silicone models to mimic palms clapping. The team studied different types of claps. Some tests smacked together cupped hands. Others clapped flat hands. Still others involved fingers hitting a palm. The pitches of those claps matched what would be expected for a Helmholtz resonator. For instance, Helmholtz resonators with bigger air pockets make deeper sounds, and cupped hands produce lower pitched claps than flat hands. That makes sense, since cupped hands create a larger air pocket than flat hands do. Understanding the physics of hand clapping, Fu says, could help identify people by their claps. Someday users might log into a device based on their unique clap. Findings could help musicians fine-tune songs with the perfect hand-smacking beat. Okay, let's do one more article from Science News Explorers. I think I got time for one after that. Analyze this. Why the fastest creatures are neither tiny or huge. I never thought of that. There's a sweet spot where muscles are strong and bodies are big enough to use that strength. Carolyn Wilkie wrote this. Cheetahs sprint across the savanna. Impalas, antelopes, and other prey gallop away. All these creatures were built for speed. In fact, mid-sized land animals are generally faster than huge or tiny creatures. New research unveils why. Christopher Clemente, he led the work. He studies biomechanics, how animals move, at the University of the Sunshine Coast. That's in Sippy Downs, Australia. Who probed the role of size and swiftness. He and his colleagues could have compared how different animals such as elephant, cheetah, and mouse move, but those creatures' leg muscles and movement differ, says Clemente. Too many things are changing. It would be hard to identify which factors limit how fast an animal runs. Instead, Clemente and his colleagues used a computer model of one type of animal, a human, at many different sizes. The team modeled humans ranging from mouse-sized at 100 grams or 0.2 pounds to elephant-sized. That's 4,400 pounds. That's a big human. The model showed that being bigger lets the creature take longer strides, but there are drawbacks. If a body keeps the same proportion as it grows taller, its mass grows faster than its muscle strength does. The result is an animal that becomes worse at carrying its own weight. That cuts into its speed. The most massive model humans were so heavy that their muscles couldn't move at all. Small animals are comparatively strong, but that doesn't make them the fastest. No, no, no. The mini model humans showed why. Small critters' muscles push them off the ground too quickly when they take a step. That decreases the amount of force that they can generate to move forward, says Clemente. Once they produce enough force, they just become airborne. This is similar to what happens when astronauts walk on the moon. To lessen their airtime, small animals crouch more than large animals do. Bending their legs more keeps them on the ground a little longer during each step, but they can't take steps as quickly as more upright creatures. For speed, there's a Goldilocks zone, Clemente says. That sweet zone where your muscles are still strong, but your body mass is big enough that you can actually use that strength. The researchers shared their results in last October's Nature Communications. The findings might help engineers figure out how to design robots for motion. Okay, got a little bit of time. Let's go back to news for kids. India-Pakistan tensions grow after Kashmir attack. Somebody attacked a sweater, apparently. Tensions between India and Pakistan have been growing after a deadly attack on tourists in Kashmir. The attack has led to a serious breakdown in relations between the two countries. The countries have a long history of fighting, and many people worry that the tensions could lead to increased violence. Last Tuesday, gunmen attacked a group of tourists in Kashmir, killing 26 people. Yikes. Most of the victims were from India. The attackers are believed to be members of a terrorist group fighting against India's control of Kashmir. Not much is known about the group. Kashmir is a beautiful area in the Himalayan mountains, but it has long been a source of serious problems between India and Pakistan. Both India and Pakistan control parts of Kashmir, but each country claims that all of Kashmir belongs to it. There's a long history of tension between India and Pakistan. The two countries have fought three wars. In two of the wars, the fighting was focused on Kashmir. In 2019, after a terrorist attack in Kashmir killed 40 Indian soldiers, India attacked a training camp inside Pakistan. Pakistan shot down an Indian plane and captured a pilot. The pilot was later returned, but tensions remained high. Before the 2019 conflict, India treated its part of Kashmir as special. Following the conflict, India removed its special rules from Kashmir. This upset many people in Kashmir. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said the changes helped keep Kashmir safe. The recent attack suggests that he may have been mistaken. People in India are extremely upset over the shooting. See, after the attack on Tuesday, India took several steps meant to punish Pakistan. India cut off all trade with Pakistan. It has closed its border and won't allow any more visitors from Pakistan. India also said that it would remove many of its diplomats. Perhaps most importantly, India said it suspended a treaty which controls how the two countries share water from the Indus River. The treaty has been in place since 1960. Pakistan said India's actions were irresponsible. Its government said any attempt by India to cut or limit water to Pakistan would be considered an act of war. And with that, I'm out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.